This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I was asked to start off with a little bit of a review of the current model of service system for people with developmental disabilities in California. And throughout California, there's 21 regional centers that provide services to about 180,000 people who have developmental disabilities. Our service system is really based on a case management model, which is a very effective way of assessing people's needs, matching them to services, and paying for those services through vendor agencies that you know the system is working with. So it's within our service system, most people's needs are being met actually quite well, and the satisfaction that people report within our service system is good. But there are some structural limitations with the case management model, and so we wanted to kind of go through those, and then we can compare them to what the advantages for some people that self-determination will offer. Within the case management model, in order for it to be effective, there needs to be services that match up with the needs of the people who are relying on that system. And those services, again, have to be within the vendored arrangement that that the case management model can pay for. Within California, in order to meet the needs of developing someone's life through the lifespan and for all the different types of developmental disabilities and the needs that are expected for this system to meet, especially given the geographic and cultural diversity within our state, that's a very tall order. Some of the structural things that we'll see is that in urban environments, there may be very good services, but they may not meet the cultural sensitivity and have staff who can speak the languages and who can meet the cultural needs that the people need within that catchment area. In rural areas, even basic service needs may not exist. In best situations, there may be very good services available, but the waiting list may be so long or that they may be so impacted that they don't meet the full range of people's needs that they could serve. One of the other structural limitations is that, again, within a case management model, you have someone who's assessing needs and making a judgment about what type of service would be most appropriate to meet that need. And in many situations, and I hear this concern frequently from people with disabilities and their family members, the service coordinator's evaluation and decision about what type of services would meet that need don't oftentimes correlate with the vision that a person with disability or their family have for their life. And so that top-heavy structure of having someone who's making that decision can be a problem. And one other structural issue with this is the fact that in order for case management to be truly effective, you need to have caseloads that are low enough that people can really get to know the needs of the client, that there can be a rapport that's developed so that the client feels comfortable expressing their needs and expressing, especially when things aren't working well, being able to call when there's a problem. And caseloads in our, within our system are definitely stretched, and so that's another structural issue that you know that we're seeing. Within the point regarding the direct service staff, within our model, we are seeing, again, this is a structural issue. It's not that there's anyone who's not doing their best. But the reality is that at the payment rate that agencies are paid, that direct service staff oftentimes tend to be young, they tend to be inexperienced, and they simply can't afford to financially to work as a direct service staff for a long period of time to develop their potential. So many people who I talk with, again, with disabilities, will tell me that they're feeling like they're in a revolving cycle of constantly training new staff, constantly catching up to speed, and at some level that is a structural issue within this case management model that we're working with. And again, the limited service options that can be arranged, and that's simply because within a case management model, again, there needs to be a financial type of arrangement so that the types of services that the person needs, that they have a way of getting reimbursed. So these are all structural issues. And again, I want to emphasize that our system is not broken, but our system is challenged. And having a one-size-fit-all case management service delivery model doesn't fit everyone's needs, especially with our young generation of people who have expectations that they will live very inclusive lives, that they will live that they will not be shoehorned into a board and care day program or workshop type of structure. So they are looking for ways to create their own service, to create their own vision, and to find ways that they can find services that will match their needs as compared to feeling that they have to confine their life into the services that are available. So these are the structural issues. Self-determination actually started in 1994. The genesis of the whole self-determination movement started in 1994 in New Hampshire with the closure of developmental centers. And the families who had members in the developmental center were very concerned how their loved ones were going to receive the type of intensive and specialized care that they were receiving within the center once they moved out. And they really realized that if they blew up those boxes and said, we don't have to replicate this, and with the amount of money that it costs to support someone in a developmental center, which is quite expensive, if we had access to that money, we could find very creative ways of meeting this person's needs in a very, you know, in a very inclusive environment, giving people a lot more choices in what they did, and still meet their not only their basic needs, but their desires as far as what they would like to achieve. Within California, we joined the self-determination movement in 1998. By the time that California joined the self-determination model, there were 30 states that had already started their self-determination model as well. California was the only one that did that through legislation, through the passage of SB 1038. Self-determination started actually being implemented in 1999. There were three regional centers that were chosen. Up in the northern coast, there was Redwood Coast Regional Center, which serves a very rural population. There was Tri-Counties Regional Centers down in the Southern California, and East Los Angeles Regional Center, which serves a very multicultural population. So three different regional centers were chosen in different parts of the states that have different needs, and they were matched. It was a partnership between the regional centers and this, the area boards on developmental disabilities. So it was a partnership. The regional centers and the area boards were given the ability to find their own way with self-determination. So each regional center was said, this is our goal, this is what we'd like to do. And, you know, you develop the best structures that you can, which gave, again, a wonderful opportunity for us to identify some best practices, some weaknesses, and, you know, things that we can improve. You'll notice that there were two other stars, the silver stars. We had Kern County Regional Center and San Diego Regional Center that decided to join in self-determination. Not within the actual funding model, but they did the self-determination as well. The numbers of people, it was a voluntary service, so self-determination will always remain. And the numbers that were served ranged about 30 people per regional center. So it was not a huge test, but I think an effective one. So we talked a lot about self-determination without saying what it is. The basic idea of self-determination is that you would take the budget, the full budget that a person was allocated in the prior year, or if there was a situation to where needs had dramatically changed, then you could kind of take a look at what the standard for that type of need would be. And you are granted that budget. Obviously, it doesn't go directly to the person. It's going to go to a financial management service who's going to oversee it. or in this case, during the pilot, they were called fiscal intermediaries. The entire year's budget was deposited, and it was really left up to families to figure out, and to the person with a disability, their family, their support team, to figure out and to really reimagine what are my needs, what are my goals, who could I hire to get me there. So we had the fiscal intermediaries who received the full amount of money. That was a requirement. Obviously, again, they can't legally receive the money directly. And we're obviously going to work in almost reverse order here. They also had the option of having an independent support broker. East Los Angeles Regional Center, as part of this, of studying how self-determination was working, they found that to simply set the budget, identify the goals that people had, and to think of, and to hire the people who were going to help, it took 4 months on an average. It took 4 months, 13 meetings, 40 hours. Okay, that was simply to get the picture started and to start to implement it. Obviously, there were ongoing meetings after that. So this is a very time intensive, very much a actually going back to the way that the Lanterman Act truly envisioned people having intensive family and support and planning that would happen. I laughed because, again, this is going back to 1998, and one of the service coordinators, when they saw how long it was taking to develop this, the average caseload was 62. Regional centers now tend to have caseloads hovering around 100. When the case manager kind of broke down their duties and said, how much time do I have per person per month, they found that they had about an hour and a half per person per month. So the service, the independent support broker, really is an important role. Not that everyone used it. Some people, again, they chose to use a circle of support, involving, people from all walks of life, and they were able to do it without using service broker. But most people did, at least initially. Again, within that, people had their year's worth of their budget that was granted to them. They had that direct control over the budget. The one thing that I would like to mention is that, again, the independent support brokers, those are optional. So the financial management service or fiscal intermediaries, they have extra responsibilities. It's not just simply managing the budget. They would also make sure that people, when they hired people, that they were following the correct procedures. They were making sure that any kind of if someone was fired, again, correct procedures were followed. Making sure that people, that the taxes were paid. So all of those things fell within the fiscal intermediaries or financial management services. So that's the basic structure there. Again, going back to when this first thing, when self-determination was first started, there were three basic things that they wanted to test. They wanted to see how power shifted away from the very powerful case management system and how people adapted to having that amount of power over their life. They wanted to test whether or not lives truly got better. And the basic requirement was that costs needed to stay either the same or that would be reduced. Initially, actually, it was interesting because there were some people who wanted to state that the cost would absolutely go down. And what was interesting is that when they did studies, they found that many people actually did spend less than their full budget, and really felt that their lives were quite a bit better. So it's not something that I think anyone should guarantee, but I do think that you could certainly have some very creative and exciting kinds of changes in your life for the same cost that you had been spending prior to self-determination. One of the things that makes this a little bit tricky. In the pilot projects, the financial management services and the service brokers were both paid for through outside grants. We'll talk about the fact that changes with self-determination when that's going to begin next year. So some of the results that people had under the pilots are going to be slightly different once we start implementing it statewide. So one of the things that they wanted to be very careful for when they implemented self-determination in the pilots, and this is something that's also being spelled out within the expansion that's going to happen next year. They wanted to make sure that everyone had a chance for self-determination, that there was not some select groups that were receiving it and some groups that weren't. They were selecting to make sure that each one of these things were represented: age, gender, a good mix of ethnicities, the full range of intellectual disabilities, people living either at home, within group homes, or supported or individual or ILS programs. They wanted to make sure that they included the full range of major disabilities outside of the intellectual disabilities. And they also wanted to make sure that they had a good mixture of people who were conserved and who were unconserved. So there were controls within this. And again, this is going to be one of the things that will be a factor when they open up self-determination to a broader population next year. Within self-determination, during the pilots, they wanted to not just have anecdotal information. So they did do an intensive process of measuring how behavior issues were affected when people entered self-determination. Productivity, choice making, integration, individual planning process, the budgeting, connection with family and friends, perceived quality of life changes. It was really interesting reading some of the reports that came from this. I had no idea the types of indicators that are out there and for all these things. And one of my favorite was an integration. And I like the fact that the integration one really focuses not just whether or not people are in the community, which is one of my pet peeves, but whether or not people were a part of the community. And so I really plan on exploring the integration indicator that's out there. But if anyone's interested in some of these indicators, I can get these to you later. But I had no idea, truly, the number of these types of tools that are available to assess these. We'll get into outcomes in a later slide. One of the things about this planning process, we talked about the fact that the planning process, when people enter self-determination, that it needs to be a very intensive and a process that includes a lot of people. Again, in the case management type of model, you don't really have to do a lot of this. Your needs are assessed. You are matched with a service that someone deems would meet those needs. In this case, you're not only reassessing your needs, but you're also, again, you're reassessing, what kinds of things if I didn't need to, and since I don't need to rely on just vendored services, what kinds of things can I do if I can hire anyone I choose to do anything I want to do? What would I like to do different than I'm doing now? So one of the things I'll appreciate, and you can see this when you see Willie's slides, you'll see the type of plans that he developed. And one of the things that the case managers noted was that the plans were thoughtful, that they were innovative, that they included pictures, they included multiple ways for people to think about their lives and make choices for their lives. Plans were in plain language, which gave people a much better ability to plan what they truly wanted to do instead of, again, when we hear the jargon, it kind of puts a box around around our thinking. The plans were something that were active guides. If I ask most people today, where's your IPP or your IEP, they would have to go dig them out of the drawer if they had them at all. These plans were out in, out on the table. They were referred to, and they were active guides. And one of the case managers noted that, and this was in one of the very rural areas, they were talking about this point about service brokers were responsive. They were talking about the fact that, again, this was an area where the actual vendored services were pretty much non-existent. And they were talking about, it was amazing the type of things that the service broker was able to put together by hiring people who were in, you know, who were local and who knew the person and had expertise in the things that the person was interested in. I was talking to Kobe, the artist out who was in our exhibiting hall, about his photography. And one of the things that I oftentimes think about with microenterprises like that, we have the people who they have to hire for their support staff. Again, very dedicated people, but they're not photographers, and they're not entrepreneurs. And so one of the challenges that we have when we're trying to match people's needs and their vision with staff is the fact that the people that are in our system, they're willing to support, but it's not their passion, it's not their true knowledge base. We've got social workers trying to do business. And so in this situation, it was even harder because, again, it was a very rural area. And in the past, this person had really had very few options. But the service broker was able to put something together that really worked for that person. One of the things that jumped out in doing the research about the pilot, people were shocked. People with disabilities and their families were shocked about how much money was being spent on their services. You think about it, and again, there's nothing underhanded that's happening here. But when you have services, there's obviously, the administrative overhead, and other things that are required. And so when people saw it, my gosh, my budget is, several hundred thousand dollars a year, and they started to really question, if this much money is being spent and I've moved so little in my life, could I do better than that? And so people who, again, within self-determination, you can choose to continue to use standard vendors, or you can choose to use people that you hire on independently. So people who did go with standard vendors, one of the things that was that they found was that people with disabilities were empowered, and they started to have much higher expectations of their daily work with the people that were serving them. And it makes sense. When you start to understand, wow, this is so many dollars per day, I need to step up my game, first of all, as a consumer, and make sure that, that I'm making this day count. But I also am going to have higher expectations. With outcomes, one of the case examples, a man who was had been in a workshop actually stole away one of his support staff, who was someone that had always been of good support to him, hired him directly, and within a very short period of time he found competitive employment that matched what he wanted to do. And one of the things that you see repeatedly, and as you read the evaluations from self-determination, was how powerful it was for people to have the control over who they hired, to have the control over truly directing them and training them the way that they felt, and the ability to retain those staff under self-determination, at least within the pilot. Again, there were no extra expenses. People had the full amount of their budget. And they were able to sometimes increase the direct service staff's salary by 70%. And I say that with a word of caution, because what you're talking about is you're talking about just the hourly pay. And you're not going to be, that's not going to include things like vacation, sick time, extra training. Those are all things that may not exist. One of the things that my personal experience, I work for the last 20 years, I've supported a man with a developmental disability and with his everything from staffing to the types of things that he does in the day. As a child, he did have regional center services, and he could have reapplied for those, but he had a large enough trust that it was a decision that a choice that he could have made. And when we sat down 20 years ago and we started talking about, you know, what is your vision? Would you like to go into, you know, to have some of these costs defrayed by the regional center? He quickly made the choice. So like, no, I really want to have the full ability to, again, hire my staff, train my staff, discipline my staff, and let them go when I want to. And I don't want to have to go through a supervisor or have anyone tell me, you know, well, give the guy another chance or something. I really want that control over myself. So it's been an interesting experience. In some ways, I've had the opportunity to kind of do my own self-determination with this gentleman. And I've asked him occasionally, you know, do you ever regret that decision? Would you? It's obviously not a decision he's locked into. He could change that at any point. And he's never, ever thought, you know, that he would want that level of control taken away. Some of these things we covered within the structural limitations of a case management model. But within self-determination, they found all of these things to be true. There were within areas where there was a lot of culture diversity, they found that people had an awful lot of unspent money because they had not found services that again met their cultural needs. They found areas that are what I call service deserts, to where again, you know, rural areas, this is obvious. But there's also service deserts that exist even in within areas that have the same with the same population kind of things. I look at the difference between Sacramento and some of our surrounding areas that are cities of sizable thing. And I have to say, Sacramento is actually very, very blessed in terms of the range of services that we have here compared to many of our other surrounding areas. So it's not just an issue of population. And, you know, I'm not really sure why some areas have... I have my guesses. Okay. Waiting lists are obviously a problem, as well as service denial, which can happen again when either case managers have a different vision, or sometimes one of the things that will happen is that case managers can be very intimidated by the process of going before the committees in order to get certain services. So these were all things that were identified within the pilot project. And these were issues that they found in many ways were alleviated by going through the self-determination model. Within self-determination, one of the challenges that people are going to face is the direct service, the direct staff recruitment. You think about it, one of the comforts of our current model is the fact that if we have a staff that quits, the agency simply sends someone else in. Under self-determination, you have your direct service staff. And if something happens, you're not going to have a backup unless you created something yourself that's available under our current model. So this is something that people need to think about. The advantage is the fact that you're able to recruit anyone, as long as they pass, and Tony will talk about this later, as long as they pass the basic background check. But you can recruit, you know, from outside of our usual system. Increased use of generic resources. Again, within a case management model, there are certain vendors that are approved and that we have a mechanism to pay. Under self-determination, you can choose to hire either a service or people who are able to meet your needs. In addition to just kind of the personnel issue with that, there's a great kind of a pamphlet that was put together by the State Council on Developmental Disabilities that interviewed some people who had received self-determination services. And one of the families talked about that their son needed diapers, and that the regional center had one vendor that they used for diapers, and they may have been quality diapers, but they just didn't fit, and they just didn't work for their son. In addition to that, when they received self-determination services, they were able to go to Costco or Winco, buy diapers that truly met this person's needs much better, fit better, and were more effective at just a fraction of the cost. So generic resources, you know, apply to both personnel kinds of things, but also, physical kinds of resources. And the services, again, are tailored to the needs of the person in a very personal way. When they did the final evaluation of the self-determination pilot, they found that the sense of freedom that people experienced had increased dramatically. They felt that they weren't confined in boxes, that they were able to truly dream and find ways of attaining those dreams. Family members reported that they felt that they'd always been in an adversarial relationship with the area, with the regional centers, and that they felt for the first time that for many of the families, and again, you have to remember the people who go into self-determination are dissatisfied with the current model. But for those families, they felt that they had finally entered into a partnership with the regional center. Incidentally, what I thought was interesting was the reflection of a case manager who felt that they were freed by self-determination because they didn't have that responsibility anymore. They didn't have the fiscal needs to be stewards of the resources, and that they could truly sit down and just make suggestions. And it was very interesting that a service coordinator had this exact same response as the parents felt during this process. Satisfaction, increased not only with the services, but the families really felt that their sons and daughters had grown during this process. There were some concerns by providers during self-determination. One of the issues that providers found in some cases was that the financial management services were late on their payments and didn't seem terribly concerned about that. And this was a situation where they were being put into a new role, and hopefully over time those things were ironed out. But that was one of the complaints of service providers, was that they were receiving late payments. And I have actually seen issues with financial management service on a pretty regular basis with our consumers, in terms of actually finding out what their balance is. And as a matter of fact, one of the other findings that they found in self-determination was that oftentimes people who were receiving that service, that in the final quarter of the year, when they were finally able to get their balance rectified, that their services would go up dramatically during that last quarter because they had been very careful to make sure that they didn't run out of money. But also sometimes they reported that happened because they hadn't gotten accurate balances from their financial management services earlier in the year. Another concern of providers is that they may be competing with people who are less qualified than they are and are able to provide the service and are able to provide direct support without all of the regulations that they are held to, without the training that they're expected to do. And so they felt that there was a kind of an uneven playing field in some cases. The other issue was that as I've commented about earlier, is that actually I've referred to it twice. Agencies typically have a problem retaining staff anyway. But under self-determination, there is a temptation, at least, for people who are exiting that system to say, you know what, I really did like this one job coach I had, and I might be able to offer him a higher hourly salary. So service providers were concerned about the fact that they may have increased staff turnover as a result of people in self-determination hiring their staff away from them. One of the things I'd like to just, as for service providers, one of the things that I would like to kind of like put out there based on, again, what was learned through this process was the fact that, again, the ability for people to select their staff was one of the most important things to people throughout this pilot. And there are a few agencies that I know who have a commitment to, first of all, having the people that they serve on interview panels. And something that I highly suggest that any agency out there would do, because that ability for people that are being served to have that input, and not just on an initial interview, but invite people back on second and third interviews to try out their actual work skills, and have people with disabilities being a very important part of that. Another thing I'd recommend is that I don't know if people out there have experienced this, but many agencies feel that it's important to rotate staff from client to client on a regular basis. And this is oftentimes stated as wanting to make sure that there's not an over-dependency that's built in between a staff and their support. A client and their support staff. One of the things that, again, was identified very strongly as the advantage of self-determination was the ability to retain staff and the ability to develop that rapport that people truly need to be fully supported in their life. And so I'd really encourage staff agencies to review and rethink if they're making that as part of their part of their general policy. Willie West is someone who had received self-determination services, I believe, since the very beginning, and I believe that he'd also it's the only model that he's experienced since he's moved out of his home. And I'm very disappointed he's not here because I really wanted him to offer the kind of that nuts and bolts, how things went for him kind of a thing. The other thing that makes me disappointed that Willie's not here is that I have a bet with my wife. When I first met Willie, he came into a room and I was like, that guy looks just like Adam Sandler. I turned to my wife and said, who's that guy look like? She goes, John Travolta. So I really wanted to get kind of like a poll of which one, John Travolta and Adam Sandler. I'm not sure how those go together, but... But Willie's a wonderful guy, and I hope that he's able to come and do future presentations on his experience with self-determination. But one of the things that's kind of like highlighted within the slide is that Willie really feels that self-determination, he can't imagine his life without it. And I've heard Willie several times say that he's really sad that the numbers at this point have been so restricted. So to him, you know, he really feels that it has created a life that is very different than he would have had under the traditional service. One of the things that Willie talks about here is the fact that he has a very diverse circle of support. And this, again, is something that is very important if someone's going to enter self-determination services. You are needing to reimagine your life and reassess your needs. And that's very difficult to do without having input from people who have a lot of different experiences and have a lot of different connections. I love the fact that, you know, he talks about, you know, he's had employees, he's had executive directors from, I know that Don Morley, the director of the area board in his area, has been a part of Willie's team. And so he's had the opportunity to have some very experienced people on his team. And he's also had family. I love the fact that's included. And here he's giving kind of the overview of the way that he started with self-determination, with again, reviewing the budget that he had within the prior year of his service, working with a broker and trying to figure out the types of activities that he would like to engage in and the type of staff who he could hire to meet those. Discussing the types of things that supports that he would need to move out of his home, and again the safety nets that he would need that to be in place. And again, that's something I just really feel I need to emphasize, is that people need to think about, they're not going to have just an agency saying, okay, we've got another staff to come in here. There are obviously agencies out there that you can have short-term, you know, staff come in, but as those, that's much more typical in terms of your living situation than it is in terms of if you had a job, if you were having a job coach. It's going to be harder to find someone who could do that on the fly for you. This is, as I mentioned earlier, this is a good example of the type of plans that are very different than a traditional IPP or ISP or one of our other P's that are out there. You see, Willie decided, you know, to use this model of using pictures and finding multiple ways of imagining his life, his needs, and the types of supports that he could have. The goals are also quite different than you would oftentimes see in an IEPP. You wouldn't normally see someone say, you know, I have strong arms, or I want to have strong arms. But, you know, frankly, we should. we should open up our process to really ask people, it's like, what's important to you, not just what can the regional center provide for you, but what's important to you and how can we make that be part of your goals? So this is kind of a good example of Willie's using generic resources. He did research. He called around. He said, gosh, I'm interested in doing this. What are some typical places that would meet the needs that I'm looking for? He called the companies or called the agencies and say, I'm looking for this. How much do you charge? And go through that. He went through that process. The services charge the plan the same amount that they would any other customers. And so, you know, it was, a really empowering process to go through this. And I like his last statement here. It makes me feel like I'm in charge of my services instead of someone who doesn't know me. He wasn't having to filter his dreams through our service system to say what would be appropriate to write onto the plan. He didn't need to filter his dreams through someone who'd say, well, that's not really what we're talking about right now. You know, we need to focus on our services. So I really liked that, the way that that the system worked for Willie. This is a list of some of the services that he buys. Of course, he needs to roll in the financial management services. And actually, it was interesting for me to see this slide because I wasn't sure within people who are currently being served within the pilot if they were at this point needing to pay for financial management services, but they are. So some of my concerns about the impact of that, it's good to see that he's already doing that. One of the things down towards the bottom, the advocacy conferences, that's something that's a very creative type of thing that under our current model what may not be something that could be, found a way to pay for, or some might be difficult for under a case management model, to have put in your plan and have funded. But within self-determination, you are allowed to really set your dreams and find the services that will allow you to do that. One of the things while I'm on this slide, Willie mentioned paying for the lift maintenance of the vehicle. Within the original pilot, people did not need to match the things that they paid for within certain service codes. One of the things that some people involved in the very early part of the pilot had concerns about was that I'll give you a couple examples. One family remodeled their home so that it was more accessible to the person. That's a very reasonable idea, actually, but it is one of those gray areas where people would say, was this remodel really for the benefit of the person, and should the surface money have been spent for that? Another situation, a family had an unreliable vehicle, and the family purchased a new vehicle to make sure that they could transport their son and daughter to the events that they needed to get to. Again, that caused some people some unease. Another situation was that a person was the father was working in a job that didn't have time off, and when he would need to take time off to again take care of the needs of his son or daughter, he would use that money to reimburse himself. I think those are all actually okay kinds of things. But it is something that you can see where people would have concerns about, about whether or not those are appropriate use of resources and whether or not that could be abused. Again, as we talk about it, you'll see that those kinds of opportunities have been closed off within the new model.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.